Even as presidential candidates deliver their messages across the nation, Bruce Springsteen is traveling the country delivering his.
This is a song called Living in the Future, but it's about what's happening now.
Springsteen and his E Street Band just resumed the tour for an album called Magic. Since they last performed a few months ago, the presidential field has gone from many candidates to a few.
But I feel a new wind blowing through the air.
The author of Born in the USA and The Rising performed last week in Hartford, Connecticut. He also sat down to talk about mixing music and politics.
An election year is a year where people have a debate about the type of country they want to live in. And I like the band being out there and being a small part of that debate.
Which Springsteen was in 2004. He campaigned for Democrat John Kerry. Though Kerry lost, Springsteen's new album refers to a famous line from Kerry's youth. The Vietnam veteran once said, "How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?" Bruce Springsteen is 58 years old. On stage, he still swings around the microphone stand like a gymnast on a sawhorse. Backstage, he sits on the edge of a couch. He keeps his hands on the seat behind him. He doesn't always make eye contact, so he seems almost shy as he talks about politics.
You can be marginally helpful, but you can also be marginally destructive if it's not handled well and if it's not authentic.
When you're writing a song that has political content, do you find yourself saying, "That's too overt, it's going to beat people over the head, you got to shave the line"?
Yeah,
a little
I do
bit.
That all the time. I mean, it's a tricky bit of business because for me the song has to have a life both outside of its political context and at the same time contain your politics. And
meaning it has to work as a song even if you don't follow the politics.
I think for me, yeah. I mean, otherwise you're stuck with a headline, you know, or you're stuck on a soapbox. And there's times for that. But for me, I wanted the music to have sort of a variety of lives, you know, and so somebody could listen to A Lonesome Day and it can sound like a breakup song or it can sound like 2001.
In so many of those human stories that you tell, you create characters, whether it's a steel worker or a guy cooking methamphetamine, someone committing a crime, or a kid in the Bronx, characters who, even if they do something wrong or bad, are affected by circumstances beyond their control. What makes you focus on that kind of story?
I guess it was just a story that I learned early on that I told well, you know. So I forget who said it, but somebody said that interesting musicians or artists are the people that have something eating at them constantly. So I was drawn to those specific questions, I think, probably because of the way that I grew up, because I could feel those forces later on when I looked back at my childhood and the effect on my father's life, but my mother's life also. Those were the questions that arose, you know, how they came to live the kinds of lives that they lived. And you know,
how were they affected by circumstances beyond their control, your parents?
Well, let me see. My folks grew up in, there was a little town. My father struggled very hard to sustain a job and to hold on to work, and they both barely scraped by. I always remember my mother. We had a finance company that was like 100 yards from our house, you know. And it was just a part of our life, you know. My mother would go in March and she would borrow till the summer, and then she would pay off. And when she got it paid off, she would go and borrow again, and it would get us through the next. It was this constant cycle of financial struggle, you know. And they had a pretty difficult life, you know. And amazingly enough, you know, we were pretty protected from most, a lot of it, I think. You know, my mother was, and remains to me quite, you know, quite noble, because she was the picture of consistency. You know, she got up in the morning, got us off to school, went to work, and this went on day after day after day after day.
When you write in a song called Long Walk Home, that, well, it seems you're saying, it seems the character is saying that the country is not the way it's supposed to be. You know, the flag flying over the courthouse means certain things are set in stone. Who we are, what we'll do, and what we want. You describe what the flag is supposed to stand for.
Mm-hmm.
That things are not turning out the way it is supposed to be. Is there a time that things were right in this country?
I'm not sure that's exactly the way to look at it. I think that the song doesn't look back nostalgically. It looks more towards the future, I think, you know. And also, it also looks towards right now, the course we're on, and to how well is the American promise kept for most American citizens. I mean, if you look back through the past 6 years and you see what's happening. I don't need to spiel through the litany. You know, there's no habeas corpus, the curtailing of the civil rights. You realize how easy it is for those ideals to be subverted. So the idea was that guy is trying to talk to his son and say, look, there are these things that are supposed to be sacred, and they make us who we are, and they direct us and guide us in what we do. Those things are important to remember, never more so than when the country's under stress and under, you know, when times are hard, you know. And that's where we are right now. It's gonna be a
long walk home. Bruce Springsteen's latest album is called Magic. He also explained how politics grew into his music over the years. And there's an audio slideshow on Springsteen's influences at npr.org/music. In town, I play a sales grocery. Barber shop on South Street. I looked into their faces. They're all rank strangers to me. There's a veterans hall high on the hill. Still silent and alone. The diner.
And another sports great says he aims to win every tournament he enters this year. And so far, he's making good on that promise. Golfer Tiger Woods says he's playing better than ever. Which brings us to this exclusive report from commentator Frank DeFord.
This is a very important announcement, so please, everybody, turn off your cell phones. The three American Grand Slam golf tournaments, the Masters, the United States Open, and the PGA, have just announced that for this year and for the immediate future, they have all been canceled. Speaking for the three tournaments, Billy Payne, the chairman of Augusta National, said that it just all seemed pointless to play the tournaments, inasmuch as it was a foregone conclusion that Tiger Woods would win them all this year and for, as Mr. Payne said, as far as the eye could see. This action follows on the heels of two PGA Tour decisions just last week. As surely you know, it canceled all those tournaments which Woods was not scheduled to play in because nobody cared about those. Then yesterday, the PGA announced the cessation of all the tournaments Woods was scheduled to play in because it was obvious he was going to win all those by several strokes, and what was the point? As one tournament executive said, golf is getting to be like the Harlem Globetrotters beating up on the Stooges, but at least that's fun to watch. Tiger winning is like watching global warming. Please turn off your cell phones until this commentary is over. Then you can call your friends with the news. Thank you. At least for now, the British Open is still planning to be held this July at Royal Birkdale. There are two reasons for what is now being called the Huckabee holdout of golf. First, the Scots are hoping that their chubby favorite, Colin Montgomery, might yet just once catch lightning in a bottle and actually not choke and finally win a major. And secondly, because the dollar is so weak and the pound so strong, there is some talk that even Woods may not be able to afford to leave the United States to play in Great Britain. The news of the cancellation of so many golf tournaments comes on the heels of a front-page New York Times article which reported that the number of American golfers is plummeting. The reasons given are that golf is too expensive and takes up too much time. 14.5 million otherwise decent American men admitted that they have never seen their wives and children in daylight hours during golf season. Another reason cited is that cell phones are banned on many U.S. courses, and 6.3 million American men admitted that they simply could not go without cell phones for that long a time. But the largest reason cited for the alarming decline in golf participation was that Tiger Woods was so good that he was discouraging all golfers. 78% of golfers cited the so-called Woods Perfection Depression Syndrome for giving up the game themselves. Please, please keep your cell phones off when golf is being discussed. Woods himself could not be reached for comment. He was in seclusion, working on improving his game and how better to hold up trophies high and kiss them for the photographers. Thank you for listening. You can now turn your cell phones back on.
Frank DeVord joins us from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Wherever President Bush may travel next, it's reasonable to assume it may not be Brattleboro, Vermont. That's one of two Vermont towns where voters apparently want him arrested for violating the Constitution. Brattleboro voters approved a measure that would instruct police to arrest the president and vice president if they ever drop in. One man says he voted for the plan even though he realizes it's, quote, extreme and silly.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today, the House takes up a bill that would require health insurers to provide the same coverage for mental illness as for physical ailments. Congress has tried to do this before and failed. And you see the challenges now when you look at the differences between two lawmakers, a father and son. Here's NPR's Julie Rovner.
Most people don't know until they actually need mental health care that many health insurance plans don't provide coverage as generous for psychiatric conditions as they do for physical ones. Two presidents and a bipartisan majority in Congress have been trying to rectify that situation for a dozen years now, pushing a bill that would require parity between mental and physical health insurance benefits. Business and insurance groups have long resisted, afraid it would boost costs. Early last year, it looked like victory was at hand, thanks to a hard-won compromise between mental health, insurance, and business groups. That came as a huge relief to longtime sponsors like New Mexico Republican Senator Pete Domenici.
The bill was supported openly by all the associations of any significance, like NAMI.
That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
And all of the companies that issued insurance. And companies that bought big-time insurance like General Motors, etc., they all bought this approach. So we really thought we had it and that nothing more had to be done.
Nothing, that is, besides getting the bill passed by the Senate and House. The Senate went first, with Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy, Domenici's co-sponsor, pushing the measure through his committee last spring and then through the full Senate last September. But a funny thing happened when the bill got to the House. Sponsors there, including Kennedy's son, Rhode Island Democratic Congressman Patrick Kennedy, decided not to take up the Senate's carefully negotiated bill. We reached the younger Kennedy on his cell phone.
Our approach has been more ambitious because we felt that we had a opportunity, given the rules of the House, to go further in the effort to provide even more comprehensive mental health coverage.
And Congressman Kennedy isn't the only one who didn't embrace the Senate compromise. David Wellstone co-founded Wellstone Action with his brother after their father, Minnesota Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone, was killed in a plane crash in 2002. Paul Wellstone had originally teamed with Senator Domenici to try to pass a mental health parity bill. But David Wellstone refused to allow this year's Senate bill to be named after his father, as earlier versions were. He says the Senate measure simply doesn't guarantee enough coverage.
My dad always believed you can't leave people out. You can't have people like Kitty Weston, who was his friend and my friend, whose daughter had an eating disorder, and went in and was told we have to figure out if this is a medical necessity.
That's because while the Senate bill does require parity between mental and physical health coverage, it still allows insurers to limit the types of mental ailments they cover. The House bill is much broader. It doesn't require that insurers offer mental health coverage, but if they do, it would have to be much more comprehensive than many plans offer now. But that could pose a problem of its own, say mental health groups that support the Senate approach. Andrew Sperling represents the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He says he fears the House bill might unintentionally override state laws that now require some mental health coverage, but only of serious mental illnesses like major depression or schizophrenia.
You would have families that now have guaranteed coverage under their state law, would under a new federal standard have their employer have the option of eliminating all mental health benefits.
Then there's just plain politics. Senate sponsors say the House bill simply can't pass the upper chamber. Representative Patrick Kennedy says he thinks that's not true, but he says he's willing to compromise anyway.
I'm not an all-or-nothing person. I want something, and then I can add to it next year and the year after that. That's the way Congress works. I've watched my father over the years. I've taken lessons.
He's going to need them. Once the House passes the bill, he'll be at a negotiating table across from his dad. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
In 2005, Anne Rice's book, Christ the Lord, Out of Egypt, was published. Now, 3 years later, she's come out with Christ the Lord, The Road to Cana. David Kuo has this review.
Who is Christ the Lord? With those words, Anne Rice opens her new novel. The question is posed by Jesus, the narrator of the book. That Ms. Rice has chosen to write the book from the point of view of, well, God, is an artistic challenge and gutsy move. Spiritually, it is the question of the last 2,000 years, desperately needed in this day, where some theologians have rendered Jesus little more than the accidentally crucified socialist, and others as an aspiring head of the RNC. The reality is that Jesus has been lost in the context of our time, reduced to an almost cartoonish amalgam of Cesar Chavez, Mr. Rogers, and Pat Robertson. It is precisely this character of Jesus that Anne Rice undoes in her new book, The Road to Cana, the second in her Christ Our Lord series. The novel is a wonder. Ms. Rice clearly revels in the artistic and spiritual challenge of creating a fully human Jesus, and she succeeds. This Jesus she brings to life transfixes. In narrative pacing and character development, Rice's Jesus is a revelation. He is vulnerable, grasping at the contrasts of his life, the amazing stories of his birth, magi, shepherds, and angels, and his life as an unmarried man in a worn woolen robe in a dusty, drought-stricken town. He is fierce, confronting an accusing crowd and calling down torrential rains from heaven with an unspoken prayer. He is a man in love. In that love, we find the dramatic and theological core of The Road to Cana. Her name is Abigail. She is the town's beauty, and she is tenderly crafted by Anne Rice. Jesus dreams of her in dreams he cannot control, dreams all men dream, dreams of lips against lips. But he cannot have her. This he knows, though he does not know why. The heartbreak of this loss of this very human love is profound. It reintroduces Jesus as a man of sorrows in a very approachable way. But Abigail is more than a love interest. She also serves as a metaphor for our own brokenness and the extent to which Jesus will go to heal that brokenness. There is a scene that left me gasping. Abigail, victimized by the culture's violence and her bitter, broken father, goes out of her mind with grief. She appears in a hidden grove where Jesus rests, pleading with him to take her, to make her the harlot she concludes she must be. He resists, but not because he is some asexual being. He does not take her because he knows who she really is, a precious and innocent soul in the midst of great anguish, and because he knows who he is, the sacrificial lover, to her, yes, but also to humanity. At tremendous personal cost, Jesus shields and shepherds her through the crisis and into the arms of a man who can give her what she needs and longs for. We are all Abigail. We spin unaware, lost, reaching for comforts we do not really want. But in the midst of our occasional confusion and panic, Ms. Rice reminds us there is one who knows the way of sorrow and confusion and loneliness and temptation, and who wants to comfort and shield us. The Road to Cana is a masterful book written by an extraordinary writer at the height of her powers. It deserves to be read for that reason alone, but it also deserves to be read to better understand the most dynamic person in human history, Christ the Lord.
David Kuo was Deputy Director of the Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives in the Bush administration. He is the author of Tempting Faith.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And today's last word in business goes out to millions of Dungeons & Dragons fans. The word is game over. Gary Gygax, co-creator of the legendary game, died yesterday. He was 69 and had suffered a variety of health problems. He was one of two men who came up with Dungeons & Dragons in 1974. It was a role-playing game. You'd create a character for yourself. You'd play by intricate rules involving wizards, elves, and dwarves. And if you were a teenager who didn't fit in, you might escape from the real roles that you had to play in school. In a 2004 interview with Wisconsin Public Radio, Gygax said word of mouth, not marketing, made the game popular.
What it is that it strikes a chord. It enables people to experience what Joseph Campbell called the heroic quest. And it's got all of those elements, so that's why it's there. And it sure is fun to play with those people, for those people who enjoy using their imaginations and love fantasy.
In later years, Gary Gygax was sometimes visited at home in Wisconsin by some of the game's 20 million fans. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.